Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. Good morning to you, Calvin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Earl. Looking forward to this long weekend.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you know, but it's going to be blistering hot, man. I think that's kind of what we've been asking for. Well, maybe that's what you and I have been asking for. I don't know about this yahoo on the other side.
No, blistering hot. Blistering hot is not my, that's not my wish.
Hey, Sandy, how you doing? It's Friday. It's good to see you, my friend.
Yeah, I'm a little stiff. I was gardening all day yesterday, pretending to be either, I don't know, anyway, gardener.
Well, let me, you have always said you're not a proponent of that 90 degrees, 60% humidity kind of stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of stuff we're getting ready to go into. As well we should. We're going into July, right?
Yeah, I have a wide tolerance, but I used to be a runner. And I'll tell you, heat is the enemy of running.
Right.
Particularly humid heat. So now that I'm not a runner, I guess I don't mind the heat very much.
Yeah, well, so let's get right at it, Sandy. The Senate and the legislature passed
here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, the budget, biennial budget, and there's some things in it, Sandy, that I think aren't good for the urban centers or the rural areas. And I don't know how, Sandy, it is possible that the Republicans voted, you know, unilaterally across the board to take away the supplement for daycares. 2,300 daycares are projected to close.
You know, and you look at that alone, the number of people whose employment will be terminated, the daycares are all run by people with some employees, as well as taking care of a number of children. So the disruption of that to the economy, you know, the family that depends on daycare has someone who's working while their children are in daycare, right? So that the availability of a worker is probably put into question because now we've got someone who might have to stay at home. The family might now break through into the poverty level because they can no longer afford to have two workers. So you've got, I mean, the disruption and the economic impact of disrupting child daycare, the impact on the children, and also all the studies that demonstrate that adequate preschool daycare as well as preschool training is fundamentally important to how well kids get started. So this is like, it's the most hellish kind of a decision. I can't imagine it.
When you're looking at the fact that there's a $7+ billion surplus that the state has, and we know that's a one-time thing. But Sandy, you constantly talk about the fact that daycare is a main component of upward mobility long term.
Yeah, and investing in the future. I mean, if you're talking about investing in the future, if you're talking about solving social issues that we face today, child daycare is a fundamentally important thing. It's fundamentally important for the next generation, you know?
And that doesn't matter whether it's rural or urban.
Right.
It's the same thing. Well, so I don't understand how, you know, this decision is palatable to rural or urban people. It's just not right, is it?
Well, I don't understand how the Republican platform continues to attract voters when the actions are so detrimental to a cross-section of Wisconsin that is an economic cross-section. Terminating that railroad, you know, the train, right, was going to hurt everybody many, many jobs for working class Wisconsin. Many jobs.
Middle class jobs.
Upper middle class jobs for middle class Wisconsin, particularly in a Wisconsin where rural Wisconsin jobs were waning, and people who were trained in a way that could have facilitated putting them into these good jobs. I mean, it was a horrible decision. It was done for political reasons. But now we've got these ongoing decisions, like the child daycare decision just boggles my mind. The Medicaid, the termination of the extended Medicaid support affects everybody. It also affects hospitals. It affects the exposure of hospitals to having to carry now the weight of, because, you know, the alternative to Medicaid is going to an emergency room.
So, but Sandy, I all of those things, including this $3.5 billion tax cut that gives 11 people making $75 million or more a year an average of $1.8 million tax cut. Let me see if I can try to. I'm not good at the math, Sandy.
Mm-hmmm.
But they're making $75 million or more per year.
Let me just tell you this. Those people are not a big part of our listening audience, and they aren't a big part of anybody's listening audience, because there aren't that many of them.
Sandy, that doesn't include you?
No.
So Sandy, they get a $1.8 million tax cut. They're making $75 million or more, and in this tax cut, someone making under $50,000 receives $36. So, again, I'm talking to rural Wisconsin, if they're listening, because these are the people that you've elected. They voted across the board to these things. And how is it possible? And, Sandy, you mentioned off the air earlier that even this $1.8 million tax cut that they want to give to somebody making $75 million, is that going to keep them here?
Well, no. I mean, the problem is that we've got many, many people in Wisconsin who decide that they're going to live 6 months and one day in Florida because Florida does not have an income tax. They tax people. They derive revenues in Florida just as much as we do per capita, but they derive it in a different way. They don't do it through income taxes. They do it through higher sales taxes. They do it through the huge volume of tourists who pay taxes or through sales taxes. They do it in a variety of ways. But, you know, we can't get our income tax low enough to equal Florida's because we don't have the alternative revenue sources in Wisconsin to derive the revenues per capita that Florida does in other ways. So, and it's not like people go to Florida when their kids are in school, because it turns out the Florida schools aren't very good.
Right.
So when do you go to Florida? People move to Florida when their children are out of the house and they're now free to decide where they're going to live 6 months and one day. And I guarantee you that there are lots of wealthy Wisconsinites who are living 6 months and one day in Florida so they don't have to pay income taxes here in Wisconsin. And we're still catering to those people by trying to reduce income taxes.
You know, Sandy, I do. When you listen to these things that have certainly been proposed by the Republicans, and you know they want to cut $32 million and 188 positions from UW-Madison dealing with diversity. They want to wipe diversity off the map in the state of Wisconsin. I get it. I understand. You know,
well, that in a way that might be prescient to what the Supreme Court has just done. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, and we're certainly going to go there. They needed to build an engineering facility in UW-Madison that's 80 some odd years old. They said no to that.
Well, you know, they said no to that just despite. They don't like, apparently, the chancellor of the UW-Madison has gotten crosswise with Robin Voss. She's acted in a manner that was viewed as being sort of uppity and talking about her experience in other states and how Wisconsin, blah, blah. Okay, But this isn't a personality contest. This is the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the jewel of the crown. And everyone understands that every major, highly regarded university in the United States is building up their schools of engineering, their STEM education, because the future of America, the future great jobs of America, are no longer just going to be in finance, but rather engineering and intellectual property in particular. The invention of things is becoming fundamentally important. And Wisconsin has lagged in that area, and our School of Engineering is not regarded as well as it could be. So this whole school, this new facility for engineering at UW, had a real purpose, and it had a real purpose that was grounded in a benefit to the state of Wisconsin. But apparently personality conflict has carried the day, and so we can have personal vendettas carried out to essentially punish the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
You know, Sandy, part of all of this is, and at the root of it, is gerrymandering, and the fact that gerrymandering has worked, you know, to the benefit of many in the state of Wisconsin. Decisions that have been made.
Well, you know, what gerrymandering has done, you're absolutely right, but it has created legislative districts that are so safe that the legislator representing that district has no risk other than in a primary contest. And so what they're only worried about is a primary contest. And the people in the state and the general political movement that's most likely to produce a primary opponent to somebody is the highly conservative side. Okay, they're the most willfully organized part of, for instance, the Republican Party. And so it has driven Republican conduct further to the right, and it has caused the Republican Party to even represent what is possibly a minority of their own party.
Yes.
Because it's not like the conservatives represent the majority of the Republican Party, but they represent the most willful part of the Republican Party, the part that can drive you, if you're a Republican representative, into having a primary opponent. So you listen disproportionately to that side.
So, Sandy, the part of this, and our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789, they're not always speaking on behalf of the average rank-and-file Republican, yet the average rank-and-file Republican are voting for them.
Well, you know,
we're going to break, Sandy. When we come back, our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. Your thoughts. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
Take it from Wisconsin's best jammers, blockers, and pivots. When it comes to driving,
drive sober on the road,
no matter how many wheels you roll.
Because you can't lap the pack with an OWI riding your back. So ladies and guys, drive sober or get pulled over. And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Download the free Drive Sober app with a Find a Ride feature, awesome videos, and more at WITrafficSafety.org.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Highs level off around 89 today under overcast skies with a slight chance for scattered storms. Winds out of the west, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Overcast skies tonight, slight chance for isolated storms, lows level off.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone.
So another crooner morning do we have?
Crooners. Crooners, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm going home.
All crooners for you, Sandy.
To my city.
Just not Perry Como, please. Or Pat Boone.
I left my heart.
in Milwaukee, San Francisco.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Early Group Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at the same number. My co-host Sandy Williams is in the studio. So, Sandy, we were talking off the air about how is it possible that in the face of these decisions, and if you look at the budget that Republicans have passed, the average person in the state is not going to see any changes that are going to help them.
Well, they're going to see changes that will hurt
negatively.
Them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about the Wisconsin budget process is the governor in our state has this line item veto concept. So the governor can take his pen. I know because when I worked with Lucy, Governor Lucy, he went and was one of the governors who substantially enlarged and tested the edge of the envelope as to how much can you – because when I was working with him, we crossed out words that – turn negative to positive and positive to negative. And so you can cross out any words in a sentence, in a line, in a paragraph, and change the meaning and change essentially the outcome in a budget bill. So the governor of the state has the power to line item veto a whole bunch of these things. But the issue will be how many of these things were part of the agreement that was reached between the governor and
right.
and the legislature to pass the budget bill and to pass some of the other things, the Save Milwaukee financing portion.
So that usurps then now the
well, the deal part of it wouldn't usurp it. It's just that the governor would be going back on his word and would have a political problem if he didn't stick to his word with respect to an arrangement or an agreement that was reached in a negotiation over what would be in the bill. So we don't know exactly
right.
what that deal is. And we'll find
we'll
out,
soon find out
when,
right.
when he starts exercising his line item veto.
You know, Sandy, the governor right now is, you know, caught between the rock and a hard place because, you know, Democrats are saying veto it. Veto it all, mm-hmm. right? We don't want to see, and as you stated several weeks ago, what happens if this thing is vetoed and Republicans say no, it goes back to the current budget that we're dealing with now. How painful can that be?
Well, obviously, there's pain, and the legislature presumably has an obligation to itself and to all of the voters in the state to act responsibly with respect to important issues. But with the urban versus rural conflict we have, with the willingness of this legislature to respond to just a portion of their electorate, you know, the Tea Party movement taught the political world how strong a minority could be. And the main power the Tea Party movement had was their ability to give rise to primary races. The Tea Party would march into a sitting assemblyman or a sitting congressman's office and say, look, you know, if you don't do this, you're going to face opposition. And then that opposition would be well-funded and organized and have a significant opportunity potentially to unseat the person that was the incumbent. And after that was demonstrated just a couple of times, this strident minority developed a great deal of power. And the same thing is ongoing now. The strident minority has a great deal of political power, and the strident part of the Republican Party is the most conservative part. So we've got... And with the districting in the state, we have many, many districts in the state where the Republican incumbent is absolutely safe. We have Democratic districts that are set up the same way because the stacking approach to gerrymandering is to create a smaller number of safe, essentially minority districts to minimize the opportunity of a party to be in contention in what could be a majority of seats. So here we have a purple state like Wisconsin, where when we vote per capita, we end up being about a 50% Democrat, 50% Republican state. But when you look at the assembly seats, it's in the high 60% that are assembly. We have a supermajority of Republican Senate seats and nearly a supermajority in the assembly.
You know, Sandy, didn't surprise me. Certainly, I listened to some of the debates from the Democrats, you know, 8 hours, 9 hours, whatever it was. We knew what the outcome was going to be before they even did it. And across the board, it was, you know, not one Republican voted the other way, not one Democrat voted the other way. And it's just a matter of numbers, right? So you can't change that. That's where we are. Listen, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Friday. That means Friday is with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
Start spreading the news.
Oh, and Tony, though, both coast
You're
to coast.
Leaving Tony today. Bennett. Tell him, Frank.
I want to be.
This is both of them, Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra.
Oh, yeah.
New York, New York.
So that's putting butter on You're both sides of the bread.
They are longing to stray and step around. The heart of
well
it.
Into both of their
New
careers.
York, New York.
Well, they hadn't lost anything, right? You know. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, before we leave this subject, this is... and has been Wisconsin politics for quite some time now. When you were around with Governor Knowles.
Lucy,
I'm sorry, Governor Lucy. When you were around with Governor Lucy, I remember the difference in the rest of the nation used to look at the state of Wisconsin and talk about the clean politics. We were known for.
Absolutely. You know, when Lucy followed Knowles, I was part of the transition team for Lucy. Governor Knowles was extremely congenial and helpful. He was a friend to Lucy. The two of them were congenial friends. The party politics was honored, but it was very civilized and very congenial, and it was clear that everyone was interested in their version of what was good for Wisconsin. But they were all interested in improving the lot of the state of Wisconsin and everybody in the state. And
there was enough to go around.
And there was enough to go around. And that was clear because of – and it was clear in the Lucy administration. He passed the machinery and equipment exemption, which was probably the most profoundly a good thing for business in Wisconsin as a Democrat. The world was different then. And the world was not the partisan politics was not a blood game. Okay. It was not a blood sport, and it's become a blood sport now. And it's become a blood sport that ignores the welfare of the general state and looks at very specific interests. And we have this rural-urban kind of a conflict now that's open, notorious, and is extremely detrimental. You know, the things that are being done are, you know, there's this expression, dog in the manger, where you do something just because it hurts the other guy, even if it doesn't help you. And an awful lot of politics now has looked like dog in the manger. And I would say that it became most profoundly obvious after Scott Walker,
yes.
during and after Scott Walker, where it all surfaced in the most clear-cut kind of a way. Tommy Thompson's administration had been congenial, and
yes.
many things were accomplished. He was a long-term Republican. One of the reasons he was reelected so often was the sort of centrist approach to helping Wisconsin that occurred there, and the same with Doyle. But then Walker came along. And it was the beginning of blood sport politics nationally and locally. And I think it's the reason why he was briefly considered as a presidential fodder, because he was at the leading edge of this. And Alec and the people, the groups that he represented, the national conservative groups that sort of decided to be embodied in Scott Walker.
Well, you know, Sandy, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, it appears that at that point in time, the state of Wisconsin and Scott Walker and what they were able, Rance Priebus, Ron Johnson.
Well, but there was also national conservative think tanks who had ready access to Scott Walker and who helped him, you know, the Bradley Foundation and the people that are related to that and the right. foundations that are related to that had very direct input into Scott Walker and the things that they had sort of theoretically concluded would be very interesting targets for conservative politics became manifest in Scott Walker's campaign and in his conduct, particularly Title 10, which was, this profoundly
Act 10,
which was aimed directly at union organization, and Wisconsin became a right-to-work state.
You know, Sandy, you're absolutely right because they were able to move that to Washington. Wisconsin politics wound up.
Wisconsin was always a laboratory. It was a laboratory for progressive politics. You know, La Follette was the leading edge of essentially the New Deal, and then Wisconsin was a model for good government, for clean government,
right.
cleaning up patronage and getting patronage out of politics. Wisconsin was the leading edge of that. Wisconsin has long been a laboratory. We adopted lots of legislation in Wisconsin that became the model for national model legislation.
Right.
Wisconsin was always the leading edge. So I guess in a ironic kind of a way, we became the leading edge for this move in a backward direction, essentially attacking government itself and trying to strangle government. And Wisconsin was part of that too.
So Sandy, do you see in the near future, because this has to change. If the state of Wisconsin is going to move forward, that includes rural Wisconsin as well as urban Wisconsin, and we can come back under one accord or, some semblance of one accord. Do you foresee that in the near future? Do you foresee that happening?
Well, I certainly hope so. The interesting thing is that the University of Wisconsin in Madison was always, in a way, a prime actor in developing this very reasoned and reasonable approach to politics in the state. We had a very high intellectual content for Wisconsin generally. We have a very well-educated state. We have a state that was very well-educated in places like UW-Madison, and those thought processes are what contributed mightily to Wisconsin being this leader state in so many ways. And here we now have, however, sort of a direct attack on UW-Madison.
Yes.
So in a way, you can see that maybe the legislature understands that this drive in Wisconsin towards being sort of a progressive leader was founded in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, so maybe what needs to happen is an attack on UW-Madison, which is what's ongoing.
You know, 844-967-2789, 844-967.
Talking about universities, I think we should shift to.
I was getting ready to go there.
Yeah.
Okay, and so the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, struck down affirmative action and admissions. And I wanted to ask you, and one of the things...
Well, the defendants in that were...
Asians.
But the plaintiffs were Asians. The
right.
defendants were two lofty educational institutions, North Carolina University, sort of one of the very best public universities, and Harvard University, obviously one of the top private universities, both of whom have for quite a number of years sponsored what was, affirmative action type programs for adding diversity to their student body. And And I went to Harvard myself. One of my roommates, my freshman year at Harvard, was an African-American kid from Barry Williams. We shared a name from New York. We've remained friends forever. He changed my life, you know. He was the first black man's hand I ever shook. You know, I went a white kid from Whitefish Bay. I played football maybe against a couple of black kids. But, you know, when he stuck his hand out to shake my hand, I realized, my God, this is the first. And I was asked by Harvard at the time, would I be willing to room with someone of a different race? I said, I thought I would be eager to. But the universities are going to get over this quickly, because I think that there are plenty of ways to get around using race itself rather than socioeconomic factors as ingredients for admissions. Because I'll tell you, it's vitally important to the people who go to the schools, to the educational experience they realize at the schools, to have diversity in the classroom. It's vital to our society that there be upward mobility offered to all sorts of people. And it's clear that the testing that's always been utilized was in many ways always biased against people who were socioeconomically deprived. They came from families that didn't read as much. They came from schools that didn't have as high level of education. They came from cultures that didn't necessarily drive them in the direction of being able to test well, regardless of their intellectual capacity, okay? And so schools are going to get around this because they have to, because it's important to society and it's important to corporate America. Procter & Gamble, there were plenty of amicus briefs, meaning friends of the court briefs, written by corporate America in support of the affirmative action programs.
So let me ask you, because at the root of, I think, a lot of this is the fact that K through 12 education is so imbalanced, and so we can't then expect, if K through 12 education is in many instances, depending on where you live and where you come from, not right. equal and equitable, how can you then expect there to be a level playing field once those same people matriculate onto a university?
Well, absolutely, and that was part of the view of the universities that as and you know in today's world, many universities have dropped both the ACT standard test as well as the College Board. I've got grandchildren going to college now. Most of them tell me that in their admissions they can decide on their own whether they want to submit standardized tests to the universities or not. And one of the reasons the universities dropped standardized testing was because their expectation was that the Supreme Court would rule this way. My expectation was that they would. I've always thought that affirmative action expressed the way it is was on thin ice with respect to the 14th Amendment, where it says basically that you can't use race as a direct applied criteria in most circumstances. And while the universities could stand up and say, yeah, but in this circumstance, we're doing it for really positive reasons. But, you know, that's a slippery slope. What's a positive reason? And, you know, right now, I heard on the radio this morning that corporations could be allowed maybe to continue using it if they can show that it's in their corporate interest. Well, 50 years ago, it would have been in the corporate interest to continue
to discriminate,
okay? So, like I said, it's invidious, but there are other factors. We can use zip codes. We can use all kinds of other factors that will have the implicit effect of improving the opportunity for people of different races.
Sandy, what the way it appears to people of color is that now all of a sudden the United States Supreme Court wants a colorblind society when it comes to education, which is something that we don't have now. It's also been, what, a little more than 60 years since the universities were forced to start accepting people of color, because by law, they were denied. People were denied an opportunity to go to the universities.
Right.
To somehow now, 350 years, 400 years up from chattel slavery and other things, Sandy, to now say it's been discriminatory based on what the 14th Amendment says, it's hard to look at that and say, hey, oh, by the way, we've had enough. 60 years is enough to level the playing field. Hold the thought. Got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. It's Friday. It's Friday. My co-host, Sandy Williams, will be right back.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Louis. Yeah, you know, these songs clearly stand the test of time. Long after you and I are gone, these songs will still be around, right?
People will still know who Satchmo was.
Yeah. They're still going to know who all these people are that we're playing today. Got to go to a break.
We're coming back from a break.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. Fridays with Sandy. Sandy, this is without question a discussion that is in the early stages. Will be clearly carved up in and looked at. It's not a final, that's what I'm looking for.
Well, the Supreme Court, it's not a final precedent.
Right.
Well, I mean, it didn't put the final nail in the coffin, but the language of it makes pretty clear that affirmative action in its current format, where it expressly talks about using race as a positive, minority race as a positive. And the fact that it was brought by Asians, for instance, well, they say that there's this invidious discrimination against Asians because Asians do so very well on all the standardized tests, and yet they don't. Their percentages get limited by the fact that there are going to be other people who are let in on account of race, for instance, black students who don't test as well.
So Sandy, let me ask you this then. So there's also something in universities where, you know, families, doors are opened a little bit more.
Legacies, yes.
And athletics.
Yes.
And so how come we don't touch those?
Well, they aren't race.
Okay.
although I'll say that legacy ends up being essentially race because legacies of most universities that had racially restricted patterns in the past end up being white.
Yes.
But my view is that the universities, at least certainly the ones that were defendants in this case and most universities, are very aggressively and positively on this bent in a direction of trying to achieve racial diversity. And that means as well African-American, black diversity. And I think that one thing that can't be viewed as being discriminatory is geography, okay? And all the universities have always pursued geography. They'd like to have people from every state. Well, maybe they'd like to have people from every zip code. And maybe they'd like to have more people from some zip codes than other zip codes, or at least have zip codes represented in a way that was going to be reflective of whatever, okay? Zip codes have this factor, okay, in America, particularly the disadvantaged black America, live in very segregated places. And those tend to be segregated within zip codes. And so you can, by going through zip codes, we all know about several zip codes in Milwaukee, right? You can take zip codes that are socioeconomically and racially in minorities and use those as patterns for selecting students and not be accused of being racial. Now you're being socioeconomic. Socioeconomic diversity is not forbidden.
So let me tell you, Sandy, where the fear is and lies with people of color. This is the beginning of striking down these businesses opportunities where minorities have to have set asides in business opportunities that have attempted to level the playing field. And so this is not the end,
so
but only the beginning.
You're right. So that, for instance, the municipalities that enact legislation that say that if Milwaukee is going to contract for something, they need to contract with minority employees. Yes, I would say that, that those kinds of things, based on this precedent, will come under attack now and could by this court, under the rationales they've applied, find those local legislative pieces overturned. And that is troublesome because obviously we are trying to make up for problems that exist in the past and we're trying to cure problems. And some of the problems that currently exist are racial problems. And so how do you attack racial problems ignoring race? And it will become more difficult.
So when you look at these things, and this was no surprise, this has been coming for quite some time. So those in the know in my community, I mean, not just locally, but nationally, have been preparing, seeing this slippery slope that was, you know, you didn't have to be blind to see what was coming. When you have a Donald Trump who says, let's turn back the clock.
And let's make America a great again. Meaning, I guess.
Yes, and so we're here at this point, Sandy, and the future seems troubling to say the least, as it relates to these racial components of the society, and you know, I'm really concerned about the future of young children that I spend time working with and talking to.
Well, I will say this. If they would focus on, if there was a way to accomplish this racial end, but still make sure that we're focusing on the socioeconomic conditions that are the plague of many people of for instance, African Americans. One of the things that happened with respect to this requirement that there be a minority representation, where there were law firms formed, I know in Milwaukee, young black attorneys who had gone to Harvard, who had great opportunities to work in various law firms. I know a fellow who worked at Foley and Lardner, who then went off into a minority law firm because they knew that they could be employed and would be employed under this condition and would essentially have ready access and an advantage. They didn't need this advantage, and they were right. This form of approach was not actually accomplishing the end it was hoping to accomplish because these people already had all the advantages. And so similarly, If a black kid from Beverly Hills whose parents are millionaires in the movie industry gets into a school because they're black, we haven't accomplished the outcome we're looking for, which is to create upward mobility for people who don't have it.
So, Sandy, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. What say you? It's Friday. Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.